Well, thank you all for coming this afternoon. Another beautiful afternoon in Holton Village. Again, it's a pleasure to be here, both in Holton Village and to get to meet so many great folks out here. Again, thanks to the Holton Village staff. If there is any wisdom that comes out of today's discussion, the thanks go to primarily to my patients who have taught me a lot of things over the years. And thanks to my wife, Kay, who has taught me how to listen to people. She's obviously not very successful. What I would like to do is, as I did yesterday, I gave you the conclusions first, and then we got, so that anybody wants to leave, I am going to take the liberty of the first 3 minutes here and just repeating the conclusions of yesterday's subject. This is the first of, actually it's going to be, it's morphed into 7 sessions altogether. There are 5 kind of formal sessions. There's a session tonight at 8:30, which was set up at the suggestion of Jim Bodine. It's just an informal discussion. We can just come here and talk about anything that's on your mind that might have some peripheral relationship to medicine, healthcare reform, death and dying, ethics, whatever you'd like to talk about, we can kind of talk about. The first session was about healthcare in the 21st century, from a global and international perspective, and these are the conclusions. I'm going to read them real quickly, but I just think it kind of leads into what we're going to be discussing today. Number one, health care is not health. So the goal is not just to get more health care. The goal is health and wellness, and health and wellness have many determinants. Health care is one of those determinants. The others are genetics, social economic factors, which play a really important role, environmental factors, and behaviors, smoking, lack of exercise, things of that sort. Healthcare accounts for less than 10%, overall, less than 10% of the quality of health that people experience. So emphasizing healthcare is not necessarily going to have a huge impact on health. And we'll kind of see that today in some statistics. And depending on the situation in a given country, given society, or given group of people, these different factors may have different weights. And the example would be Pakistan after the floods. That's environmental factors are going to far outweigh almost anything else that's going to take place in the country over a brief period of time. It's also, my point number three, what is it? It's possible for a country to spend too much on health care to the detriment of health. And if there are really multiple factors, and if social economic factors are one of the most important ones, and socialists, and economic inequality is a major factor in healthcare, then anything that promotes inequality, and that might be pumping lots of money into a healthcare system, might in fact, if you're taking away from education, you're taking away from the environment or public safety, then you might actually be making health worse. Sounds counterintuitive, but but I believe it's definitely true. The next point relates to the U.S. healthcare system is absolutely unique amongst advanced industrialized countries. Every advanced industrialized country has a single system. We went through the kind of 4 systems. You can have national health insurance, you can have a true form of socialized medicine, you can have kind of a Bismarck model paying out of pocket. But every industrialized country has chosen one system. We have a little bit of all 4, and we have a whole bunch of people that don't get covered at all. Every other country has universal coverage. Every other developed industrialized country has universal coverage, has non-profit basic system, either with government-run or non-profit insurance companies, and have a high degree of regulation, which in this country we apparently do not want to have. And the reason for regulation is to assure quality and control costs. And the current healthcare reform efforts in Washington, D.C. tweaked the edges and really didn't do much to really deal with the basic problems of the healthcare system. So that's kind of what we discussed. That's in a nutshell of what that first session was. Was there anybody have any burning questions that came out of that session that they really wanted to handle right now? Okay. conclusions for today. I love to give conclusions. So here we go, conclusions for today. And anybody that, once you hear these conclusions, want to get up and enjoy the weather, I will not be personally feel bad about it. Number one, this sounds a lot like the first one. Longevity by itself ought not be the goal. Just as healthy ought not be the goal, longevity ought not be the goal. The goal is to avoid early and premature death and disability, and what we call in medicine as mortality and morbidity. We want to avoid those that occur prematurely. And having achieved that, we want to avoid a long, painful dying process. I don't think anybody here wants to have their dying spread out over weeks and months, or good grief, over years. And so it's long, painful, and I might add in parentheses that it's also expensive. The third point, successful, and we're talking about successful aging here. Successful aging is to accept and adapt to the infirmities and limitations that develop with age. We are not going to avoid them all. Anybody that thinks we're going to live perfectly fine and then just drop dead at 100 is probably living in a make-believe world. Now, that may be a goal that we have. So with those limitations, we have to learn to accept those and adapt to them. The next point is to maintain and foster a sense of curiosity and wonder. If you do that, that's going to get you a long way to a good, successful aging. We need to foster and maintain a gratitude for our experiences, a purpose in our lives, and joy in our relationships. And we'll see how all those things really are important in terms of, it's got very little to do with, you notice I haven't really mentioned cholesterol or PSA tests or anything else. Right, we're really talking about other things that really foster successful aging process. And then I'd like to have two quotes here, one from Thomas Jefferson, one from Jimmy Carter, both presidents. Thomas Jefferson writing in a letter to his friend John Adams shortly before they both died on July 4th, which is kind of an interesting thing that they both died on the, I'm not sure what year it is. Can somebody help me know what year Thomas Jefferson died? But John Adams died at the same day, believe it or not. And Jefferson wrote, "There is a ripeness of time for death, regarding others as well as ourselves, when it is reasonable that we should drop off and make room for another growth. When we have lived our generation out, we should not wish to encroach on another." This is a common, this kind of goes back to Ecclesiastes, and you know, there's a time to be born, a time to die, and the metaphor of the tree losing its leaves and then for new growth coming the following year. But Thomas Jefferson, obviously a very wise man, writing to another close friend. And Jimmy Carter has just a comment. This is my last point in conclusions. He says, "You are old when regrets take the place of dreams." Old when regrets take the place of dreams. Anyone wants to leave, they can leave. Okay. Okay. I have for you some philosophical questions that will kind of underlie a lot of our discussion today. So think about these. There's no answer to these. I think the great discussion points for later, perhaps tonight. One, is there a maximum age limit for human beings? And number two, should we attempt to extend the maximum lifespan of human beings? And what are the implications of that if we are successful? We've been successful in extending it, but we really haven't gotten past that maximum. Is ageless youth better than the seasons of life? Boy, that's a hard question, isn't it? Or maybe it's not. I mean, for any one of us or whatever. Should age be a factor in rationing health care? Should age be a factor in rationing health care? And what are the benefits and disadvantages of the elderly being segregated in retirement villages and nursing homes? Are there advantages and disadvantages of that? So those are some philosophical questions that probably are worth spending some time about. Well, a lot of people have written about aging and what it means to age. If you look in the dictionary, there are two main definitions of aging or age. And the first one in the ninth edition of the Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary says, age is to become old, to show the effects or characteristics of increasing age. That's not a particularly great definition. To mean to become old is to look old. They have a second definition, which I think is really much nicer and certainly applies to me. To acquire a desirable quality by standing undisturbed for some time, to become mellow or mature. So that should be number one in the dictionary. We could probably look at that. I have here an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association, dated May 2nd, 1896, about aging. There's some very interesting things here. And they went back and they looked at the registration report of the state of Massachusetts between 1843 and 1866, looking at physicians who died and other professions who died, just to see, you know, you'd think physicians are smarter about health kind of things, they might live longer. And 820 physicians died during that period of time of 23 years in Massachusetts. The average age was 55.84. Lawyers, 56.21. They lived a little bit longer. Clergymen were 57.7. And judges were 66. So judges lived a whole lot longer. The problem with that is that I think in order to become a judge back in those days, you have to be older. You know, so if you can't become a judge, you can become a lawyer or a physician in your 20s and 30s, but you couldn't become a judge until you were maybe 40, 50, 60 years old, so that's going to skew that. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the judges are really were all that great. Writing about the art of prolonging life in 1796, and here's a quote, physicians who so abundantly dispense to others the means of health and life ought to claim here a distinguished place, but unfortunately this is not the case. It may be said of them in general, in serving others they are consumed, in healing others they are destroyed. Why would you go to medical school, huh? And finally, there was they came out with some advice for physicians as they got a little bit older, what they should do about their career and how they should take care of themselves. So this is 1846. And it says, the lesson, then, we should learn from our deceased colleagues is not to work too long. When you find your arterial tension increasing, and for those of us who are got gray hair here, you know, think about the description here because it's really great. When you find your arterial tension increasing, your temporal artery becoming tortuous, your radial growing hard, especially if you have a little palpitation, and pass an increased amount of limpid urine. Whatever your years, know that old age is upon you. Henceforth, shape your life like one who is old. Curb your ambition. Be content with a small practice. Reduce your expenses. Give up your night work. Decline confinements. Take a long summer vacation. Retire early. Drink not at all. Sell your horse.
No.
Take a great deal of moderate exercise in open air. Wash the functions of the skin. Guard against the chill. Cultivate an even disposition. And study to be quiet. Be good advice back then. Anybody here own a horse?
Yeah, that advice is not good.
All right. Well, people obviously have been thinking about longevity and dealing with their mortality for a long period of time and thinking about how to live long and healthily. It's not rare to live to 100 anymore. That was one of the questions we had there. Can you live to 100? Do you want to live to 100? It's not particularly rare. Want to give a guess as how many 100-year-olds there are in the United States right now? How many think there's less than 10,000? How about between 10,000 and 40,000?
I'd say
about between 40,000 and 70,000? Anybody think there's more than 70,000? There's 75,000 people over the age of 100 in the United States right now. I mean, that's pretty impressive. By the year 2050, predicting that that we have a mild increase in longevity over the next 40 years, they predict that there will be 1 million people over the age of 100.
By when?
Sorry?
What year was that?
2050. So that's 40 years from now. It's a ways off. But all our kids in that next generation is going to be around when this huge number. There are 75 million people alive today who will reach between the ages of 90 and 100 by 2020. 75 million. We're talking about the United States.
Yeah.
75 million people will reach 90 or above by 2020. Now, 2020 is not that far away. That's a huge number of people. And greater than 50% of the 74 million baby boomers who are alive today will reach greater than 85. Right now, there are 16 million Americans who are over 85. There's a lot of old folks around. Well, what about life? We showed life expectancy in multiple different countries yesterday. So let's look at this first graph over here that looks at life expectancy in the United States. Well, this is not the United States. This is just life expectancy. This is United States. This is 10,000 BC. So we look at life expectancy over a historical time period. 10,000 BC, birth of Christ, 1000 AD, 2000 AD. And we see, if we look back here, 10,000 BC, all the way through the birth of Christ, and all the way up to like 1850, it didn't change very much. It was 22 years at the birth of Christ. So we think of Jesus as being snuffed out in the early years of his life, in the 30s. I think remember that when he was born, his life expectancy was 22 years. That's kind of a different way of looking at it. We kind of think of things. So we started to see a real inflection in that curve in the starting in the 1700s and the 1800s, and it really accelerated through the first half of this century. Now it accelerated long before anything that modern medicine has done. Accelerated before we had vaccines. It accelerated before vaccines. It accelerated before antibiotics. It accelerated before any significant kind of surgery. And what made it accelerate? A couple things. One, infant mortality started to improve with better nutrition and with an understanding of infection at around childbirth time, and we began to get some public health measures, clean water, and better sewage management, things of that sort. So that's where the change, that's where the real big increase. And then through the first part of this century, our parents or grandparents who were born around the turn of the century had a life expectancy in the 40s. By the end of the century, people who were born around 2000 or were born right now, life expectancy is in the high 70s and low 80s. So that for every year you could delay in being born, you added between 2 and 3 months of life expectancy. That's really phenomenal when you think about that. By adding that life expectancy, you just wanted to be delayed. So right now, it's about for every year you delay being born, you have about, what's 10%? About a month. You live about a month longer than somebody that was born a year ago. So we're still adding on this period of time. So let's look at curve number two, which looks at survival here. This is percent survival in the various over a period of time. This is kind of an interesting way of looking at it, because when we talk about life expectancy, we're talking about what is the likelihood of being alive for someone at a given point in time, that they're going to be alive so many, or how old they're going to be when they die. even back in 50,000 BC and 10,000 BC in the time of Rome, there were people that lived into the 80s and 90s. It wasn't that everybody died at 22, but there was this huge drop off, very, very quick, in the very early years of life, continued to drop off very significantly over a period of time, and a few managed to still be kicking around when they got to be in their 70s and 80s. And it changed gradually over a period of time, but not all that dramatically. The real dramatic change came in here between Roman times and between our present time. And this is, would be the ideal curve. You're born, you live perfectly well, you get out to be about 95 or 100 years old, you're stricken by something, and you drop off the curve. I mean, and you have this life right out here, and everybody lived. You can see that this curve is beginning to approach that. And that we have, so that if we're going to shift this curve, who's going to benefit from that shifting of the curve? Old people, right? I mean, we can't do a whole lot more back here. We can improve it a little bit, but that's not where most of the deaths are occurring. So if we, with all the work and all the kinds of things that we're doing, medical research, everything you hear about, we're not really saving a lot of kids now. We are adding on years at the end of life. So that we're putting a lot of resources into having somebody live, instead of 80 years old, they're living to be 81. And it's costing society a lot for that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, but I think we just have to understand that we're not really improving the life expectancy and necessarily the quality of life of younger people. And in fact, if we eliminated all cancer, if we eliminated cancer completely, we would extend life expectancy by 3.1 years. That's all. So instead of dying, and we also know that if we had a decent healthcare system without eliminating cancer, we could, and we had the same outcomes that Japan has, or that Germany or that France have, we would extend life expectancy for 3 years. And if we eliminate all vascular disease, we're only going to increase life expectancy by 4.5 years. So it's kind of phenomenal statistics when you look at it that way, because you kind of think, of course, we're really going to add a whole lot to it. Another curve here I want to show you. And that is who dies. Now, this is pretty much true across all cultures, and this is a mortality rate. This is how old you are. So infant mortality, childhood mortality, relatively high rate. Boy, nobody dies in the late teenage years up through the age of 40. Not nobody dies, but not very many people die. I mean, mortality rates are really low in that group, and then they start to increase dramatically. And anybody have any ideas why that might be? These are reproductive years. This keeps us going as a species. So we've been really selected for that, to be healthy and strong and powerful during those years, and then our value to the species really drops off. And so that's kind of an interesting evolutionary finding. The other, I'm going to show you one other graph that's kind of interesting, I think. And that is, when we extend life, are we extending high quality life of highly functional individuals, or are we extending life of people who are really dependent on others and have accumulated a whole bunch of disability along the way? And so this looks at functional capacity. This looks like where we are right now, even from early on. There are some people who are going to be the special needs kids, people that are early in life that are disabled and have functional needs. So we don't start off at 100% of the population. And then it progressively drops off with age, so that as we look at when we get out to people in the 80-year-old age group, large percentage of those are really functionally disabled. Ideally, we'd like to keep that all the way out here and down, but what are we going to be able to achieve that? And if we eliminate the killer diseases, heart disease, stroke, cancer, pneumonia, That's what we're really working on. We are gonna be left, what are we gonna die from? We're all gonna die, I guess we all, but that's pretty clear. What are we gonna die, we're gonna die from Alzheimer's disease, severe degenerative arthritis, you know, all the degenerative kinds of diseases, the Parkinson's disease, those kinds of things that I think most of us would rather just drop dead of a heart attack. So we're making huge strides and have made huge strides in terms of reducing those killer diseases that kill us quickly. And in fact, one of the big things that we do in medicine right now is put implantable defibrillators. Are you all familiar with that? So, I mean, I think the Cheney's had one for a whole long time. And so that prevents quick, sudden death. And it guarantees you that you're gonna die of something much more slow and painful. but that's considered a great advantage. There are a number of theories of why we age, why we get old, and the bottom line is that nobody really understands why every species has a finite lifespan. We do not find a dog that lives for 50 or 60 or 70 years. That just, no dog lives that long. Some of the longest lived species, there are whales that live up to 200 years. There are some turtles that live, tortoises, the ones in Galapagos live for 150 years. Elephants can live 50, 60 years. But every species, fruit flies, usually live somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks. And they don't live longer than that. So that every species, and humans don't live beyond 110, 120 years. The oldest documented living person was Madame Jean Calmette from France, who died in 1998, 122 years of age, totally blind, totally deaf, had been bedridden for many years with arthritis. The quality of her life clearly was not great, and that's the longest known survivor. Once you make 100, the statistics demonstrate that 50% will die per year. So it's a high mortality rate. We're really dropping off at that. We just hit that, and we just drop off. And why that is, there's theories about telomere length on your chromosomes. There's theories about accumulated mutations in the DNA. There are theories. I have a novel inside, based on some scientists who discovers the death gene that we all must carry. I mean, we must have some kind of thing that sets our limit, and that we find how to turn that off. And that scientist, of course, is immediately kidnapped by the mafia control this. And it's worth. You can imagine what it would be worth. That would stop aging instantaneously. So you'd have that. Turn that off on people. I mean, it would be really a great story. All right. Any questions about the overall aging, the statistics, the population kinds of issues? And the next step we're going to step into is kind of talking about what we die from and then what we can do, if anything, to try to improve the odds that we're going to be around, improve the odds we're going to be healthy, productive, continually productive people. Overall causes of death in the United States, heart disease is number one. One of every three of us will die of heart disease. That is gradually decreasing because of the interventions that we have. So that when I did my internship and residency at the University of California in the late 60s and early 70s, if you came in with a heart attack into the university hospital there, you had about a 40% chance that you would not leave alive. It wasn't because I was there. Regardless of who was taking care of you, I was waiting for Don to make that comment.
While you see me out running on the road.
A typical mortality statistics, you have a heart attack, you show up at any major hospital is going to be, your mortality rate is going to be around 5% or less. Huge change. And you're going to go, you'll be taken to the cath lab, they'll find out exactly where the blockage is, they'll put a stent in, you'll be treated with medicines that lower the likelihood of a subsequent heart attack. Cancer makes up another roughly third of people. The number one cancer killer of the cancers is lung cancer. Strokes is number three, and then we get a lung disease, accidents, and things of that sort. Now that's overall statistics for the United States, and those are the and that applies to the elderly. That applies to most of us in here. If you're in the age group of 15 to 30 or 15 to 35. That group that has relatively low mortality. What do you think the number one cause of death is? Now, it was heart disease in the older group. What do you think the number one cause of death in the 15 group?
Accidents.
Yes, by far. Accidents, number one. What about number two? Number two and number three are pretty close to each other.
Suicide?
I'm sorry?
Suicide?
Suicide is number two, absolutely right. And number three is homicide. Wow. That's something. Number four is cancer, number five is heart disease, and that starts to pick up with time. But the three top causes of death are all violent deaths of one way or another. So accidents, which are quite a bit above the other than suicide and homicide, and depending on the population group, whether suicide is number one or number two or homicide is number two. Another way of looking at reasons how we die and the impact of death is something the statisticians use, and they use something called the YPLL, which is the years of potential life lost. So they're going to give much more value and a higher rating to someone who dies at the age of 20 than someone who dies at the age of 90, because that 20-year-old had a lot of potential life, the 90-year-old didn't have a lot of life. But they don't set it at 90, they set it at 65. So if you die less than 65, the number of years up until age 65 is considered a year of potential life. If you die over the 65, it doesn't count. That's just a statistical thing. It doesn't mean that you're not important. So the number one cause of loss of potential life is accidents. These accidents continue to be high all the way up until you get to be pretty old. Then the accidents really drop off. People, I guess, don't drive as much, or they're less likely to. And certainly, people don't get killed as much. Either they don't commit suicide frequently, or homicide is quite a ways down. Suicide is number four. So it's accidents, cancer, heart disease are the three, with number four being suicide in terms of years of potential life lost. All right. I was going to say something at the beginning of this of the discussion. I didn't. There is a list. Those of you who were here yesterday have seen the reading list. Three of the books on that reading list. One I mentioned yesterday, How We Die by Sherwin Nuland, an old book written in the 90s, but still a very good book that really talks about disease and how people die and his experience as a surgeon at Yale Medical Center for many, many years, a very wise man and a good writer. Two other books about aging. One is Jimmy Carter's book, The Virtues of Aging, which is just kind of a nice view of how to find meaning in your life. And I think Jimmy Carter is somebody who, at the age of 86, continues to find meaning in his life. And this study, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Nunn study, N-U-N. It's a study done by David Snowden, who is a great book. If you're interested in Alzheimer's disease and prevention of Alzheimer's disease and the factors that go into development of Alzheimer's disease, I strongly recommend this book. What he was able to go to a group of, big group of nuns at a convent. Can somebody help me? Was it Wisconsin or
Minnesota?
Minnesota. Yeah. Right in your guy's backyard there. And convince these nuns that to be examined and to have some interviews to agree that when they die they would allow their brains to be examined pathologically, so they could look to see what the pathologic findings were versus what the medical and psychological and intelligence intelligence tests were, and they kind of put this all together. Plus, this particular order of nuns, in order to get in to be a nun when you were 16 or 17 or 19 years old, you had to write a 2 or 3 page essay about why you wanted to do it. And they kept all of those. So they have information from these nuns from their very early life, and they can look at the words that they use and how, whether they were positive emotions being expressed or negative emotion, or whether they were enthusiastic, and they found out all kinds of things about them. Now, the nice thing about the nuns is that, number one, they were all women. Number two, they were they all had medical care. You know, and so they, we didn't get into the thing about some of, you know, some people had insurance, some people didn't. Their records were very clearly kept in terms of what jobs they had and what they did, and the, as far as within the company. There were some that really did physical work all the time. There were others that went on and got PhDs and were teachers. So they had a whole bunch of information about these nuns and put it all together and came out and concluded that there were 4 factors that prevented their mental deterioration. And this is, and the data are just overwhelming here. Number one was exercise. Those nuns that were physically active throughout their lives had a much lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease, both in terms of the pathology in the brain and in by testing. The second factor was education. The more education they had, the better they did. The third factor was enthusiasm. They looked at the they had a scales that they looked at that. And the fourth factor was positive emotions. And those two kind of go together. But those people that were extroverted and positive and enthusiastic and experienced the joy of life all did better. And one of the remarkable things was, not only did it affect the pathologic findings, that there was a gradient. So you could have all kinds of tangles and plaques. You've all heard of tangles and plaques that occur in the brain. Those are characteristic pathologic findings for people who have Alzheimer's disease. And we all get some, or as just an aging process, so that even those people that are super sharp at the age of 90, they're going to have a little bit of this. But if you looked at the nuns, who you look at their pathology, those that ranked the highest on those 4 factors, exercise, they're all E's, exercise, education, enthusiasm, and positive emotions, even if they had the same degree of plaques and tangles, they were functionally much, much better. So it allows you to overcome some of the pathologic changes that occur in the brain. So I got something from the Old Testament I'm actually going to read here. This is going to blow Dawn away here. And you guys probably know this, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth the bones. I'm not sure where it came from the Old Testament, but it's but it really points out the positive enthusiasm, the positive emotions, and how that is a helpful factor. All right, good book, great study, just well written and really interesting. Other factors that go into, that contribute to longevity and quality of life. Taking a nap. People who take naps tend to live a little bit longer. There was a big study out of Greece that if you took a 30-minute nap, you had a 30% reduction in heart attack rate.
I was just wondering who took a nap in this room today.
You know, a nap here in a holy villa seems like a waste, doesn't it? You know, so many things going on, it's so beautiful, but I lay down and went right to sleep this afternoon. But your nap, don't make your nap too long. If it's longer than 60 minutes, it actually is worse than not taking a nap. So set that alarm clock for 30 to 60 minutes and you're okay if you're going to take a nap.
Have you ever read some rationale as to why that is? That seems
about the time.
Yeah.
Yes, because if you take longer naps, it disrupts your sleep pattern later on. And one of the real important things here is connecting with nature. And one of the parts of connecting with nature is to connect with the day-night cycle. And there's all kinds of studies in animals. If they put animals, you know, they keep turning the lights on and off on these poor animals, you know, so they don't know whether it's daytime or nighttime. They die young. There's been studies looking at airline pilots. It is not good to be switching through time zones frequently. You know, like you. Look what happened to Don here. He showed us his slides last night, all his traveling he did.
I feel bad for Don.
So the longer nap, I mean, I don't know if that's the answer about the longer nap, but longer naps do disrupt sleep cycle. And so when they talk about good sleep habits, they say don't take long naps. And that's consistent with that Greek study. Having a pet is a good thing. And pets do a lot of things. One of the things that pets do, especially if it's a dog, you go for walks with them. So that adds the exercise part to it. And, you know, pets... And, you know, most people who are married will say a pet is better than a spouse. Unconditional love, you know, they're happy to see you when you come home, you know. Now, cats may be a different person. So that leads us into marriage. I'm sorry, I missed that one.
I wouldn't dare say that.
Well, I have an understanding why. All right, let me talk about being a woman. We saw those data yesterday about the longevity, and women live longer than men in every single society, with the exception of Iceland, where it's equal. Now, I don't know why, and I don't know if anybody has really looked into that, but in Iceland, it is equal. Women don't live longer than men in Iceland, but in every other place where it's been looked, women live longer than men. And it's not super clear why that is, but there was a study recently done and published with genetic engineering of mice where they, and this is going to upset all of us guys because you can genetic engineer offspring without the need of a man, without the need of a male. You know, you've heard of that kind of thing. It's not cloning, but it's taking two female genomes and putting them together, and so you're going to produce only female offspring because there's going to be no Y chromosome. So it's just female. It's a double female kind of thing, and they don't have the male genes from the Y chromosome. And these mice live 30% longer than other female mice, and clearly longer than the male mice. So that's a fascinating thing. So there's something in the genetics of the female species that allows them to live longer. So it seems to be a genetic factor. So you know, in these Brave New World things or in Star Trek where there's a planet with just women, you know, the Amazons, you know, they don't need men around or whatever. Should I tell them this thing? I have sisters, but I had a younger sister who was really a devil. And it was a program on television that, I don't know, with Buck Rogers or somebody, they went to a planet where there were loudspeakers blaring all the time. And the blaring was, men are weak, women are strong. Men are weak. You know, this was it was to brainwash the population. She used to go around saying that all the time.
That is a true story.
This is a true, I'm not making this up. I mean, she did it, and she
still says it, too.
Men are weak, women are strong. So she had something there. She knew. Anyway, what about marriage? This is some fascinating stuff. In 1858, was the first big epidemiologic study by a guy by the name of William Farr. He was a British epidemiologist, one of the first, a father of epidemiology and medical statistics. And he classified people into three groups. You either married, you were unmarried, means you never got married, you never were married, or you were widowed. And they found that the people who were married lived the longest, the people who were never married lived the next longest, and the people who were widowed died the soonest. And that's been, it's been called the marriage effect, and numerous studies demonstrate that. The more recent studies demonstrate that it's much more nuanced than that. And of course, back in 1858, they didn't look at gay couples or cohabiting individuals or even divorced people. So lots of new studies turn out, and it turns out that married people tend to have a lower incidence of pneumonia, They require less surgery, they have fewer episodes of cancer and heart attacks, less homicide, and fewer motor vehicle accidents. But when you really start breaking it down into troubled marriages versus what would be considered a good marriage, or less, it turns out that troubled marriages have worse outcomes than people who never marry. And divorced individuals have worse outcomes than people who never marry. So, and getting remarried doesn't get rid of all the problems of a divorce.
Gives you another spouse to deal with.
But you don't get back to like a first good marriage. But a troubled marriage, and they have all kinds of ways of looking at, you know, what constitutes a stressful marriage, and they've done a lot of research on that. A stressful marriage is the equivalent of smoking a pack a day of cigarettes. So at Ohio State University, there are people from the Department of Psychiatry and the Department of Immunology worked together, and they looked at the response of the immune system to stress and the stress of a marriage, within the marriage, and came to the conclusion that it's the relationship is the important thing, not the institution. So it's not the institution of marriage that's good, it's the relationship between two people that seems to be the beneficial component. And they did some great studies. They took 90, this is really great, they took 90 newlywed couples that seemed to be happy. You know, they looked like they were just nice, happy couples that recently married. They hooked them up so they could draw blood from them every, and they sat them down at a table and said, okay, we want you to talk about housework, or we want you to talk about money or sex, things that in most marriages induce some kind of stress and potential, you know, controversy. And they thought, well, this is an experimental setting. There are people watching this. They're videotaping this. You know, these people are going to be pretty good. They really got into it. You know, they yelled at each other. They got angry. And they were able to look at this. And those that got the most angry and the most nasty had the greatest reduction in their immunological capability of fighting off infection and things of that sort. It's really remarkable what that kind of stress would do. There's a positive side of that. They did another study where they hooked up the woman. I don't know why they did this, just the woman, but they hooked her up to an electrical thing to give her shocks. They didn't do the converse of this. It was just the women that were getting the shocks, and they gave them a chance to sit there and just get the shocks or and then the next part of the study was to sit there and have a stranger hold their hand while they got the shocks. And the third was to have their spouse hold their hand while they got the shock. And it helped. A stranger had some benefit, but having a spouse that held their hand, it reduced the adverse effects of the shocks on the immune system. So there's some positive things. I mean, pointing out the positive kinds of things. Their conclusions were avoid getting nasty in fights. I mean, that there's going to be controversies. It's the people who didn't show any warmth at all when they were arguing. They didn't show it. You know, didn't put their hand on the shoulder and say, honey, you know, you sometimes drive me crazy. Okay. Other things that I'm just going to run through real quickly. Alcohol in moderation clearly prolongs life. Alcohol to excess shortens life. No question about that. So we're always very careful in medicine not to prescribe alcohol because of the potential of abuse for it. But there's no question that alcohol moderation, and there's a lot of evidence as to why it might work. It works on cholesterol levels, on the good cholesterol and the bad cholesterol, the HDL and LDL. Big British study, those individuals who have sex twice a week, and they didn't say who they had sex with, but they said but if you had sex twice a week versus sex of once a month, And so all cause mortality by 50%. And I led to a great cartoon in the New Yorker, and I wish I, if I had my slides, I'd have it up there. And this guy's in bed with his wife, who's turned over facing the other way, and he says, "Honey, you're killing me." connections with nature are really important. Hospitals have recognized this now, and if they don't have a nice view out the window of green landscape and trees, they're putting big paintings on the wall of landscapes and things of that sort, trying to make that connection because recovery is better. Music is another factor. People who either play instruments or involved or enjoy and appreciate music, it seems to have beneficial effect. Gardening is one of the great things in terms of, it gives exercise, it also gives that connection to the land. Chocolate. How many like chocolate here? Okay, one of the things that chocolate, especially the dark chocolate, contains a substance called phenethylamine, and that produces a type of euphoria. It is a very similar, it stimulates the same receptors that are stimulated when you have sex and have orgasm. So there really is something about chocolate being the way to a woman's heart. So, or man's heart, I guess, too. So that's something. Spirituality and faith, we're going to talk about that tomorrow, so I'm not going to really bring that up. There are some real factors here. Optimistic people seem to do better than pessimistic people. So,
we're really bad here. We're saying, well, okay, bring on the chocolate twice a week.
We just run out of time. I did have something about how to be a good patient and some advice from one of my patients who I once asked, I've asked all my patients, what is it that makes a good patient? What makes the physician good from your perspective, and what makes a good patient? And I could share that tonight, perhaps. To go back to what Jimmy Carter has to say, or actually this quote right here from in the Aging with Grace, just like to close with today. He is talking about Sister Genevieve, who is 90 years of age, an elderly nun who's obviously lived a long time, and that as he talks about her, and he's thinking of the author is thinking about the kinds of things that make life really important. He says, as medical advances and improved living conditions allow ever more people to survive for 9 decades and beyond, the quality of life versus its quantity presents a staggering challenge to the so-called oldest old and to those who care for them. And for those of us who've had sandwich experiences, I think we all know that we still may have kids in college and elderly parents who are requiring more and more care and attention. And he writes, he says, "The more experience I have with the older sisters, the more I realize how few of us hope simply to survive. We want to retain our ability to reason, to remember, to express our thoughts, to read a new novel, or even the newspaper. We want as much as possible to remain independent of others when it comes to moving about, dressing ourselves, eating, and using a bathroom. We want to be spared the suffering caused by chronic illness. We want to live in communities with people we love and people who love us. In short, we want to have what Sister Genevieve has, including, odd as it may sound for a woman who is now 90 years old, a future filled with hope." Wow. And I think that's what successful aging is about. So it's going back again to my very first one of these conclusions here. Long lecture. maintain and foster a sense of curiosity and wonder, gratitude for our experiences, purpose in our life, and joy in our relationship. And that supersedes living longer, getting your cholesterol down, all these other kinds of things that we spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and at end of life, we medical professionals should be ashamed of what we do to people at end of life in terms of making everything oriented to the medicine as opposed to not giving people a chance. I mean, how many people that you know personally in this group that have patients, have friends, family members who had cancer and who spent the last 3 or 6 months of their life running into the doctor's office, getting radiation therapy, and being in the hospital, and not experiencing the relationships, spending the time with the people they love, or the hobbies that they had still could do, because they were so being poisoned and being forced into a medical system to prolong their lives by a few months, perhaps. So anyway, thank you all very much.
Thank you.